Well, hello there. Welcome back to Inside Ivy Hoops, a podcast about Ivy League basketball. Thank you for joining us on the Ivy Hoops Online world here. Mike Tony, editor of IHO, joined by writer extraordinaire Rob Brown to wrap up a fantastic season that was a season after the season that wasn't. How far we've come. It's not to be taken for granted or forgotten. How are you, Rob?
I am doing well, thank you, Michael. Glad that we've turned the calendar to April, a little bit warmer, and it's easier to ride the Ivy League coaching carousel in this time of year.
It's been an especially intriguing one. Let's hop on it to get started. Just hours ago, Harvard Athletics announcing, less than 4 weeks after the season's end and a remarkable 40-year run, I should say, for legendary coach Kathy Delaney Smith, concluded. Kerry Moore, former Princeton assistant under Courtney Banghart, has been named the successor for the Crimson. It's a name that's been bandied about for the past few Ivy openings in recent years, ever since she was an impactful assistant in the Banghart era. Somebody who's almost 6 years Kathy Delaney Smith senior, Fran Dunphy, still has some miles ahead. He's taken the job at LaSalle, his alma mater, where he reportedly could have went back in 2004, leaving Penn at the time. There was reported to be some interest there, rumored to be some interest from the Explorers program back then. Fran Dunphy taking the job at 73, 3 years after winding things down at Temple. What do you make of those two worlds around the coaching carousel, Rob?
Yeah, well, you know, for Kerry Moore, a very solid pick, a very good pick for Harvard. Interestingly, I was kind of trying to see where Harvard would go with it. The last three hires in the women's basketball group were all established head coaches. Carla Berube came over from Tufts. Adrian Scheibels came over from Bowdoin. And Monica LeBlanc came over from Merrimack. So these were people with established head coaching credentials. The typical Ivy League pattern is to hire an assistant with Ivy League credentials. However, with the success of the league the last few years, especially with Carla Berube and Princeton, I was kind of thinking, well, maybe Harvard would go for an established head coach. They opted to go the more traditional route, and if you're going that route, there's probably nobody better than Kerry Moore. A great player at Western Michigan, led the nation in scoring in 2007. Very solid career, as you said, the director of basketball operations at Princeton for 2 years. She then went to Creighton for 5 years while they were in the Missouri Valley and the Big East. She then went back to Princeton as a recruiting coordinator and assistant coach, a position she had the last year at Creighton. She then had two successful years with Banghart at North Carolina. She recruited the number 10 and number 3 recruiting classes in the country, then moved over to the University of Michigan, helped them on their run to the Elite Eight this year. So she certainly has paid her dues. She has tremendous respect around the country, especially at high academic institutions. Her players are very connected to her. She obviously can recruit well. And now we'll see. You know, she is given a really good start at Harvard. Harmony Turner, the Rookie of the Year, Mackenzie Forbes, a second team All-Ivy, Lola Mullaney, an honorable mention All-Ivy. I mean, these are three very talented people. I think there's another top 100 recruit coming into Harvard next year. So, you know, she certainly has the table set to continue the Ivy tournament run and lay the foundation to start, you know, looking towards the top of the league. So I think it's a very good pick overall. One little thing, she will have an introductory press conference tomorrow at 11:30. I reached out to Harvard Athletics. They will not be live streaming it. You know, great news from Harvard today, kind of a little bit of a slip up for tomorrow. You know, it would really be a great thing to build momentum to have that press conference open to not only the media, but to fans so that they can share in the excitement. With Fran Dunphy, an amazing bit of news, right? I mean, good for him. I know that, it seems like the story at Temple didn't play out the way he wanted to. It seemed like there were forces beyond his control that kind of ended his tenure there. So it's great to see that he gets to go back to his alma mater, that he continues doing something that he loves, really brings instant credibility to a program that has taken, you know, some steps back from the heydays of Tom Gola and the L train Lionel Simmons. So, you know, I'm sure that all Penn fans are very excited for Fran Dunphy. 29 out of the 30 nights out of the year. I guess the interesting thing will be to see how long he stays there. I know you mentioned to me that there's a possibility that it would be kind of a transition period and he would then turn it over to somebody else. Maybe that's Pete Carril. Maybe that's Bill Carmody. I don't know. You know, we'll just continue the Ivy lineage there. But, you know, a very interesting and enjoyable bit of news today.
Yeah, it's exciting. Exciting to see, anytime you have a coaching legend like Fran Dunphy, I don't know who wouldn't want to play for him. I don't know, you know, we're on the other side now of doing things differently with the pandemic. One of the big questions looming is, does Dunphy go casual on the sidelines? Does he make like Jay Wright and make the transition?
Maybe he'll grow half a mustache and kind of split the difference.
That's right. You know, the coaching carousel has extended beyond that. Mike Jordan taking over, former Ivy Player of the Year for Penn, for Fran Dunphy, taking over for another Fran O'Hanlon, a great Penn assistant back in the mid-90s before taking over in Easton, taking over the Leopards program. Good for him. Great. You know, obviously was a terrific assistant at Colgate under Coach Langle there, and had a stint in on the other side of 33rd Street with Drexel making its NCAA tournament appearance the year that he was there. So good for him taking over at Lafayette. Todd Golden, former Columbia assistant back when I was covering Penn against Columbia for 2 years there, when he was starting out, just a few years removed from his playing days at St. Mary's, taking over at Florida after 5 years at San Francisco, three as the head coach there, after taking over for Kyle Smith. Good to see that. And James Jones, one coach that's not going anywhere, as you wrote about for the site, Rob. James Jones reportedly, per John Rothstein, inking an extension going through 2031, which would make him the most the longest tenured Ivy coach in the modern history of the league on the men's side. Any thoughts on those whirlings of the carousel, or in Coach Jones's case, not going anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for James Jones, another, you know, as I noted on that article, you know, another year in the NCAA tournament, another time, you know, another year where his name is bandied about in several positions. Back in 2019, there were some conversations about GW. There were much more conversations about a little bit of, I think Fordham also was in the mix, but there was also a lot of serious conversations about St. John's, that he actually had gone to the campus for an interview. And then he, you know, turned that into an extension at Yale, I think through 2025. This year, things heated up again. There was a little bit of mention at GW, which found itself, again, looking for a coach, which I guess should worry the new coach at GW that the next time Yale makes it into the NCAA tournament, that coach better watch himself. But now, you know, there were much more serious conversations about the University of San Diego, and just when things were starting to warm up, I think there was a post at HoopDirt.com that things were getting very serious with James Jones and picking up steam, and then hours later he had withdrawn his name because of the reported contract extension through 2031. You know, well played by Coach Jones, the dean of the, I guess now with Delaney Smith's retirement, he is officially the dean of the Ivy coaches. I think he's a year or two ahead of Dana Smith at Cornell. Well-deserved honors, you know, just an outstanding coach, outstanding mentor, you know, not only within the league, but nationally. He's coached for USA Basketball. You know, it's a great thing for the league that he stays. You know, obviously, you know, coaches want to challenge themselves at the high major level on at a lot of times, but, you know, kudos to Coach Jones for staying in the league and just continuing to help it grow. So you know, I think everyone in the conference should be pleased, unless, you know, you're looking to battle for a top four spot, which he seems to have locked up for the last 20-plus years. You know, Todd Golden, great situation. You know, another extension of the, you know, two big coaching trees with Ivy League history behind them. There's, you know, at the present time, there's Courtney Banghart, obviously. There's Meg Griffith in Columbia. There's, you know, now Carrie Moore. Both were director of basketball operations at Princeton before becoming assistant coaches. On the men's side, you know, Kyle Smith certainly, you know, mentored a lot of people, and he's got a lot of the Columbia assistants with him in Washington State and also, you know, throughout the country. Todd Golden, great job at USF taking over for Smith. This year he had Patrick Tappe and Gabe Stefanini. It was great to see them in the NCAA tournament, and, you know, hopefully continued success for Golden. And yeah, like you, you know, I'm a big fan of Mike Jordan's. Was a wonderful player, you know, great student athlete at Penn. Has spent a lot of years learning under another great Penn basketball alum, Matt Langle at Colgate. Also Zach Spiker at Drexel, a former Cornell assistant under Steve Donahue. So it's great to see him get that chance also. So, you know, I think Penn fans will be really excited to see LaSalle and, you know, and Lafayette next year for their annual games, and, you know, kind of have a little bit more of a homecoming.
Yeah, and I before we move on and look at take a look back at you know, what was a very memorable postseason run with NCAA and NIT, WNIT tournaments, really on the women's side, Princeton and Columbia, some very memorable games. I did want to mention, it was a year ago tomorrow that Devin Kennedy was signed to a 10-day contract by the Orlando Magic, which, you know, he eventually got signed to a two-way contract, and then he had a right ankle fracture and was waived later. and he worked his way back from injury, and it was reported last week, Thursday, that he was signed again by the Magic to another 10-day contract. Just great to see him keeping at it, sticking around, and persevering to try to make a little more magic for the Magic, and get his career on an upward swing when it easily could have went the other way fast had he not been resilient. Of course, we've seen him bounce back before. Of course, there was the his arrest, suspension after swinging at a police officer, and a subsequent plea agreement. But I think it seems to be pretty well established that that's not who he is. He's somebody who has been impactful in the community. He's worked his way back from injury, from setback, and a pretty inspiring story. Devin Kennedy back with the Magic, and good for him. I know he had to be happy to see Princeton women's basketball program notch program's second NCAA tournament victory in its history, with really wasn't an upset, as we were talking before the recording here. Princeton topping Kentucky as an 11 seed, 69-62 in the first round of the NCAA tournament, a rematch of Princeton's last NCAA tournament opportunity with the same seeding 3 years ago in Courtney Banghart's final game helming the Tigers. This time Princeton was able to avoid a third quarter swoon and pull off the victory, and eventually fall just short at third seeded Indiana in the second round, a game the Tigers easily could have won. Made a very memorable comeback to get back in that one, even with foul trouble and Abby Myers having to sit early. It all kind of almost looked like it was going to work out, but still a great run for Princeton, who would be certainly well positioned to make it back to that position with the roster not really changing much, not projected to change much next year with Abby Myers will exit the picture, but that I think Carla Marubi's program is going to be strong for a while. What did you take away from Princeton's appearance, their two-game run in the Big Dance?
I mean, I think for me it was great that the nation got to see the team that we see week in and week out. It's a professional team. It's a mature team. It's a disciplined team, and you certainly have tremendous defensive effort both games. But Abby Myers is a wonderful offensive player, and Caitlin Chen as well. And I think it was really great. I think it was right after the first round, or maybe the first weekend of play, that Caitlin Chen's name had been searched. She was number two of all the NCAA women's athletes for people doing searches. So it was really great to kind of see the notoriety for the whole program and for her and Abby Myers in particular. Well deserved. Not as you and I both said you know, in the lead into the game, that we wouldn't have been surprised at all with that outcome. Princeton being underseeded, as Ivy League teams typically are, and Kentucky, very good team, but probably a team that was a little bit overseeded. So even though they had a little bit more of a home environment than Princeton in that situation, playing in Bloomington, it didn't rattle Princeton. They certainly were able to control that game, and you know, especially when you consider that that Kentucky had beaten the future national champions about a week earlier, and have a player that is projected to be the number one player in the WNBA draft. So a well-deserved victory for the Tigers. And it's really tough to go up the way the women's tournament is. You play those first two rounds typically at the home of one of the higher seeds. So they had a play at Indiana. It was a very loud and raucous crowd, and they almost pulled it out. You know, on a neutral site, maybe they win that game. So I think it is a testament to how talented they are that they had a chance at the very end. Bigger and better for next year. Of course, you lose Abby Myers, who will do a graduate transfer year. Guessing there will be a high major program looking seriously at her, but the rest of the starting lineup remains. I think there are two or three players off the bench. Chet Nweke and Maggie Connolly, in particular, will return. They get two top 50 recruits from New Jersey that are coming in for next fall. And ESPN, in yesterday's article, lists them as the number 23 team in the country heading into the 2022-23 season. So, I just think this is just the first step for them, and I think next year will be even better. A great weekend. It didn't end ideally, but a great weekend for the program.
And the Columbia women and the WNIT putting on just as memorable of a show there, making it all the way to the Elite Eight, getting some additional time at Levy and Jim, supported by Columbia Athletics, who's shown in the past they're willing to do that with in these non-NCAA tournament postseason situations back in the 2016 CIT that comes to mind as the swan song for the Kyle Smith era, Matt O'Low and Alex Rosenberg, Grant Mullins, going and getting all the way to the title, winning the title, the CIT that year. And fast forwarding to this group, getting all the way to the Elite Eight after a really extraordinary win to push past Boston College, a bubble team that easily could have made the NCAA tournament as an at-large selection. 54-51, almost got to the Final Four of the tournament before bowing out to Seton Hall, 78-75. Still the best season in program history. Columbia winning its first postseason game since joining Division I back in 1986. Program record for wins. You kind of run out of superlatives thinking about what Columbia was able to accomplish this season. I think expectations were pretty high, and they exceeded them in a league that maybe was Princeton's to take all along, but Columbia certainly establishing itself in the upper echelon of the league, in the top tier, it would appear for years to come. Any takeaways from Columbia's WNIT Elite Eight run?
great things, you know, a program record number of victories, a university that was very supportive, a fan base that got really excited about this team. You know, if you look, once they started allowing fans back late in the season, large crowds against Princeton at the Ivy League tournament, at all of the home games for the WNIT, there's just a lot of momentum and energy going on in that program. You know, that, of course, you pointed out the game against Boston College. Despite going 0-for-20 from three, they were able to come back and win. You know, it's something you brought up about Devin Kennedy earlier, just that idea of resilience. And I don't know if there's any athlete in the league that's been as resilient as Devin Kennedy over the last few years. But, you know, I kind of look at Columbia like that also. You know, Coach Griffin is very determined and very very, very insistent on herself and her team, and they had a lot of, you know, it wasn't an easy year, obviously, with COVID, but they had a lot of roster changes. You know, thankfully, they had a deep roster, but, you know, players had their roles changed throughout the year, and that is never easy, and you know, they handled it well, you know, as a team, as individuals. So that is a group that really, really, you know, they really play together as a unit with the whole goal of the team succeeding ultimately. So, you know, again, another team that I think really, really played well through the month of March in addition to the, you know, previous months. And they are on the up and up for next year. I mean, I don't know if they can. It's certainly a tall task to take down Princeton, but they certainly seem up to the challenge. And I think for Ivy fans, you really look forward to that. You know, two teams that have really made a national name for themselves this year, especially how amazing that is with the fact that they missed an entire season. You know, they both are, you know, deserve, you know, extra kudos for that situation. So, yeah, the only thing I think really missing from Columbia at this point is a band. And, you know, the old one wasn't there anymore, and I know there was a time where they rented a local band, but they've got to do something to get that going, because the team and the fans deserve a little extra energy and atmosphere in Levian.
Yeah, if anybody deserves it, it would be that program after this season. Turning over to the men's side, I have to be honest, wasn't as compelling of a slate this year on the men's side. Really, it was the first time in a decade that the men's representative in the NCAA tournament wasn't a 16 seed and didn't last till the final minute of the game. And we've really gotten used to the Ivies pushing the upper seeded teams all the way to the limit, to the last second, oftentimes making its way back for a furious comeback that falls just short. That seems to be the script written for a lot of the Ivies. That was the case for 14th seeded Yale back in 2019 against LSU, Harvard against North Carolina in 2015. It's pretty remarkable to think that's Harvard's last appearance in the NCAA tournament. This time Yale as a 14th seed just got overpowered inside and outshot from the outside by third seeded Purdue. What kind of spoiled it a little bit was we got to see that Purdue was in fact vulnerable. They lost to a lower seeded team, but it was the 15th seed, not the 14th seed, and losing to St. Peter's. Remarkable run by the Peacocks, of course. It's hard to be Cinderella, and Yale just wasn't it this time around. A great start by Azar Swain, Not at all like the cold shooting start that beleaguered Mia Oney against LSU and ultimately, in retrospect, did the Bulldogs in that game. But Yale just couldn't quite stick with it after the early going against Purdue. And then in the NIT, Princeton as a 6 seed falling at 3rd-seeded VCU in the first round, 90-79. A notable score, if only because VCU is one of the top defenses in the country, and that would have figured to be a low scoring game. But if you'd have told me that Princeton would score 79, would have thought they'd be in good shape and not losing by double digits. But the Rams were able to top the Tigers in that one. Any thoughts on how the men's action shook out in postseason play?
I guess the Yale result was not surprising. I know you had mentioned it in our last conversation. You know, the Purdue size was going to be too much for Yale. I think they had a chance early in the first half, but that was about it. I guess the biggest key for or end result is that they weakened Purdue so that they got knocked off by St. Peter's a couple days later. So, again, not a huge surprise. The Princeton result, a little bit more surprising, but I guess not much in the big picture when you think about the fact that they had a quick turnaround from that Ivy League final. They had to go down to Richmond. You know, never surprising when a team's just kind of maybe, you know, doesn't have the same drive or energy within the first round of an NIT game. I guess when you look at the results, it's probably fodder for those people that are not, those Ivy fans that are not big enthusiasts of the Ivy League tournament. Even though Yale came in second place, they were not the top team in the league throughout the 14-game tournament. And, you know, in the old days, Princeton would have been the league representative. And, you know, not saying they would have beaten Purdue, but maybe it would be a different game. And then, although I guess in the old days there would be no Ivy League participant in the NIT. So, you know, take of that what you will, but I do think that probably the league did not have its best representative. They had a good representative, but probably not its best. But that's what you get when you have an Ivy tournament, and you know, you go from there. So all in all, the men's results, not surprising. Not as ultimately successful as the women's league this year, but I think, you know, all in all, a great season. Again, given the fact that they missed an entire year, so I think a lot of thrills for the fans, a lot of great competitive games as is usual in league play, and they, you know, lose a lot of wonderful athletes, but a lot of great ones still remain. And I guess now for the off season, it's kind of tip your hat to the graduates and see where they head in the world of the transfer portal. Right, you've got like Jalen Llewellyn, who's going to get a lot of high major looks. Jalen Gainey from Brown, we know already, is at Florida State. There's a couple guys, Kobe Dixon and Jelani Williams, Dixon from Cornell, Williams from Penn, who are both heading down to Howard to play for former Columbia and Harvard assistant Kenny Blakeney. So, yeah, that's the next season for the men, and, you know, as we await next fall.
Yeah, and first of all, before we look ahead to next fall, what did you think about the Ivy League schedule this year? It was not, maybe not a great year to roll it out, given all the COVID reschedulings that plagued it throughout much of the schedule, really. Especially the first half of the Ivy slate, but what did you think? I feel like it was because of those COVID reschedulings, especially. It was really hard to get any sort of flow. But I don't think there, even without this reschedulings, I don't see it. I can see why the players and the coaches wouldn't want to do it, or wouldn't want to stick with the status quo of the nothing but back to backs and making that awful Columbia Cornell road trip, and, or even Harvard Dartmouth as the case may be, but. Yeah, but as a fan, I feel like it. You know, you have continuity. It's Friday night, Saturday night. It's more predictable. You know, it seems to the more fan friendly thing to do would be to revert back. I don't think that's what's going to happen. But what were your thoughts on how that shook out?
Yeah, you know, I think you make a lot of great points. Selfishly, on the writing standpoint, it was a little bit easier because there were many weeks where we could just focus on, one game per team. So it made it a lot easier in terms of coverage. I talked to a couple players throughout the league season, and they seemed, they actually enjoyed the limited bus, the lesser bus rides, or the less wear and tear. I think they knew that the flow may not have been the same, but I think they appreciated some weekends to just, have an ability to kind of, recover from the games a little bit more. But yeah, as a fan, completely agree with you. It was hard to get into the flow each weekend. I always feel like I kind of live for those weekends where it's like I know who's playing who, and I know, like, it's very easy to figure out all 16 games of what's going on. And this time I kept having to revert back to the league's grid and be like, I don't know, who, just because Penn's playing Dartmouth, that doesn't necessarily mean that that Harvard and Princeton are playing this week. So it was very confusing and a bit off-putting. But yeah, as a fan, I definitely would rather see the back-to-back weekends. Even if it turned, I still would like the Friday and Saturday. I could understand if they did Friday and Sunday, but it probably wouldn't have that same flow. Some games in the afternoon, some in the evening. I'm like you, maybe more old-fashioned. Give me a Friday night game and a Saturday night game, and I'm good. So I don't think they're going back to that. I don't know if there's a way to tweak the schedule in any way. With the tournament, would it be better for us to have the tournament the week before? If they could find a way to get that season done in a way that gives us the beginning of championship week instead of the last day of championship week, I feel like, we have a great product out there, but it gets lost amongst the big boys and girls, I guess the women's tournaments tend to be done, so it's more the men's tournaments at that point. So, when you've got the Big Ten, the SEC, the ACC, the Big East, it's sort of like, hey, there's an 11 o'clock a.m., game in the Ivy League. Like, who's watching that thing? So, I would love for them, if they're going to keep this format, if they could, speed it up a little bit so that we get the tournament a week ahead of time.
Yeah, and I will add that I'm... Yeah, it's easy for us to talk as followers and chroniclers of the league, but really the league is about the students, it's about the players. So what they want and what's best for them personally and academically is really what should rule the day. If ideally there would be a league-wide survey of players that we could consult and say, okay, this is what they want and this is what we're going to go with. It's easy to rail against it. It's easy to rail against the tournament as a whole. I still would prefer that we have a 14 game tournament and not Ivy Madness tacked on to the end of it. But whatever the players want is what should rule the day. So,
and I do think, as we've seen over the last few years, is there is, a little bit of flexibility that the league has shown with having the tournament, with changing the schedule around. There might be be outside forces at play with all of that, but I think they're, you know, they have shown a tendency to make some changes as time goes on. And, you know, we may see some changes to the tournament. You know, there have been kind of rumblings about what happens to the tournament after next year. We know it's going to be at Princeton. We know it'll be, you know, well attended because of the Princeton fan base and the proximity to Penn and, you know, possibly New York City for Columbia if they make it in, as they should on the women's side. But, you know, after that, it then becomes, I think, Brown and Cornell, Dartmouth. You know, it becomes a little bit more of a challenge of the venue. So there, you know, there are kind of some grumblings that maybe something would change after that. So we'll see. So, you know, I guess in the big picture, it's not written in stone, and we'll just have to wait and see as time goes on.
And let's look ahead to the fall. You know, this past season, there were maybe a couple of surprises. You know, Harvard on the men's side missing the tournament in its home gym after, you know, being expected to contend for the title, certainly. The same roughly true on the women's side with Penn missing out for the first time ever. You know, Penn had been the last school to have its men's and women's teams make the tournament every year, or at least qualify for the tournament. Of course, with 2020 not yielding an actual tournament, but you know, Penn missing out. And then I thought the Brown men had high expectations, and ultimately with Lilia's Rookie of the Year, Ganey as Defensive Player of the Year, Cho putting in another, first team caliber year. Individually, Brown seemed to have pieces, but wasn't quite able to put it together on the men's side to make a run. Are there teams, are there programs that you think are poised for bounce backs, or what? Do you see, how do you see next season playing out maybe differently from this season for select Ivies?
I mean, there's going to be a lot of interesting storylines next year. You know, if you start with, well, I guess pick your team. You know, if you're, let's talk about the champion Tigers, right? You've got the reigning player of the year, Tosin Omoman, is going to come back. Number of the players from the starting lineup leave, but he's there, and, you know, someone who Mitch Henderson has said is the best passer in the last 25 years in the league, and you know, how will they rebound and build around him? I certainly think, you know, with Matalaka, you certainly have one of the most tenacious guys in the league, so I certainly don't see them taking a huge step back. It may not be the same team as this year, but there's certainly, you know, that's something to keep your eye on. Penn is going to be in a real interesting spot. And, you know, as I kind of discussed during the tournament, you know, this is a team that has made every Ivy tournament, but other than the 2018 year, they've been one and out. And, you know, next year is going to be a big season for the Quakers. You've got Jordan Dingell, who is arguably going to be in the mix for the Player of the Year. Hopefully you have a healthy season from Max Larka-Lloyd and get some inside presence. They're a team that challenged for a while and faded at the end of the season. Coach Donahue said that they're really close to winning the league, to making to being a bigger player on the national stage. I think next year is a real put-up kind of year for them. I think they have that potential, and I think Penn fans are looking for that. So I think that there's going to be high expectations down on the other side of 33rd Street. Brown, yeah, you know, this was supposed to be the year for them, not just to make the Ivy tournament, to make a big run at the league title. In media day, Mike Martin said, most talented team he's had. This is a team that he expected to challenge for the league championship. they played well against the national runner-up, almost beat North Carolina, you know, at the Dean Dome. They played well against Maryland heading into that first game and against Penn in the Ivy schedule. And then, you know, as is usual, they just had two more downs than ups in league play. So I don't know. You know, you lose Jalen Gainey, you lose Tamining Cho. You certainly have tremendous athletes returning. But when is it going to click for Brown, and when are the fan base going to say something about this? Like, how many years can you come in, you know, fourth or tied for fourth or fifth place or sixth place and you miss the Ivy tournament? So I think that is going to be a big situation. Harvard, you pointed out, a lot of injuries, tremendous talent year after year, but it's also year after year of major injuries. You know, you watch a Harvard game and you see four, five, six, seven guys in, you know, street clothes. What is going on there? Is it just luck, bad luck? Is it something that's going on within the program? Lots of injuries. When is the year that they're going to be healthy and, you know, play to their potential? Tommy Amaker's a great coach, great recruiter, but, you know, sometimes you gotta have the team on the court to kind of maximize your abilities. So, you know, we'll see what happens with them. You know, Cornell, how long will Brian Earle be the best-kept secret in the East, as Mitch Henderson noted? You know, at some point he's going to get great recruits, and he's going to, you know, take his talents and really get them to the next level. Will next year be that year? Don't know. But it's always exciting to see Cornell play. Will they stay the same frenetic style that they had this year? You know, that is something to look forward to. It was each coach at the Ivy tournament talked about, you know, the consistency of playing against these other teams except Cornell, and I think it kind of threw everybody. So I'm kind of looking forward to see if Cornell keeps that same style next year. Dartmouth and Columbia, I guess for Dartmouth it's rebuilding from losing, you know, three really, really talented seniors and graduate students. For Columbia, I think there's a big question there. You know, they have shown a commitment to the women's program. Megan Griffin has showed that she's brought that mentality from Princeton of, you know, winning is the expectation. On the men's side, it's kind of been the opposite for the last few years. Losing has been the expectation. When is that going to turn? And how many years does Jim Engels get to do that? You know, he's had a lot of rough seasons. A number of them have, you know, because of injury. But, you know, again, sometimes you gotta actually put W's in the column to keep things going. So I think there's a lot of amazing storylines for the men next year. And the women, for Princeton, it's seeing how high they can go. And same with Columbia. Like, what will their battles be like? For Harvard, it's going to be, you know, how does Carrie Moore do with this talented roster? Does she bring that same Princeton ethos to Cambridge? And can she, you know, take them up a notch? For Yale and Allison Guth, you know, you've got one more year with Camilla Emsbo in place. Can they, you know, make it to the point where they're challenging Columbia and Princeton? And I think the biggest eyes are going to be on Penn. As you pointed out, the first year they missed the league tournament. They've got Kayla Padilla, one of the top talents in the league. This year, I think there were some situations that happened, you know, before the season even started with their suspensions. How does this team regroup from that? I think for Dartmouth, Cornell, Brown, it's really trying to see where they take it next year. All three of them are in a bit of a rebuilding mode. I think Cornell is probably in the best position of those three. They, you know, were able to give a lot of minutes to some of their younger players and change their style of play. And so I think they have the best potential of those three. But it will be interesting to see where the future takes those three programs. I don't know if the Ivy tournament is in their future for next year, but I'd like to see, you know, where they progress.
It is interesting now that there's an Ivy League tournament that Penn and Brown seem to get perceived a little differently, just because Penn has always been winding up in the top four, and Brown's been just outside of it. So you get that demarcation that probably would never have been there if we just had a 14-game tournament and no one was paying attention to who was fourth place and who was fifth place, only the only eyes being on who was coming in first or second. But I will say that, you know, in Penn's case especially, given the turnaround, you know, on the court and certainly hopefully off the court as well, that that Penn has made under Steve Donahue, that, you know, Penn fans aren't too restless, I would hope. You know, I've seen some Twitter buzz about, you know, from some devoted Penn fans wanting to move on from Steve Donahue, wanting to get another coach, try somebody else. They're fed up. You know, it's been 3 years, three seasons of not making the tournament since their last appearance, one NCAA tournament appearance in six seasons for Donahue. But I mean, first of all, I think with NCAA tournament or NCAA athletics in general, you know, it's not all about making the tournaments. It's you want to win, certainly, but you don't want to be in a situation where, you know, not making the tournament every year, you know, maybe struggling a little bit here and there, is something that you're going to get fired for when, you know, the pressure shouldn't really be on to that extent. You know, if you think about a program like Kentucky or Kansas, the real blue blood, you know, those are programs where even just making the tournament, I'm sure, wouldn't be enough to save a coach's job. You have to go deep. You have to, you know, you have to win conference titles. You have to put up gaudy numbers, get big recruits, all of the above. You know, that's kind of, unfortunately, I think that gets away from what college athletics is supposed to be about, and, you know, what Ivy athletics especially is supposed to be about. I feel like, you know, under Steve Donahue, the team gets it. They're engaged. They seem to be socially conscious. They seem to be trending the right way from an integrity standpoint. Same goes for Harvard, really, under Tommy Amaker. Again, very, very socially conscious group that has certainly underachieved the last few years on the court, but I would question whether or not that's more important than what's going on off the court. Kind of, maybe it sounds a little high-minded, but I think that's probably the healthiest mindset that a fan can have when thinking about what measuring sticks they should be applying to these people that are in these positions competing and trying to balance so much.
I think you're right. And, you know, when you look at the big picture of these things, and I keep saying that a lot, I think, during this podcast, you know, if you think back to what was Penn like before Steve Donahue showed up, what was Harvard like before Tommy Amaker showed up, what was Brown like before Mike Martin was there, you know, I can certainly speak in Penn's cases that athletically they were in having major troubles. You know, not just losing, but just watching the way the team was playing, getting blown out early, not seem to have any enjoyment in the game, you know, fighting with other teams. And then you talk about the moral issues involved with Jerome Allen. So, you know, certainly Penn is nowhere near that any longer. You know, Steve Donahue is certainly, just like we talked about with Fran Dunphy, you know, brought instant credibility back to the program and, you know, has recruited a lot of really great people, and they seem to have an enjoyment in playing the game and playing with each other, and as you pointed out, the social involvement has certainly been there as well. You know, in Harvard, with Tommy Emmecker, has taken it to the next level in all of those, athletically and socially. And I think Brown as well, on you know, compared to where they were before Mike was there. So there's a lot of great coaches in the league. But sometimes, you know, fans being fans and then alums being alums sometimes get a little bit, you know, emotional in these moments. But I think all in all, I think they do take a step back and look at, you know, overall, like, the positives greatly outweigh the negatives in all of those coaches' cases.
Yeah, to be sure. And of course, as far as off the court items go, something to keep an eye on is the Ivy League's antitrust exemption being slated to expire in September. September's end. Got a lot of unknowns there. Don't know. That's not cut and dry like sports are, where we have clear winners and losers. Not entirely sure what's going to happen there, but just something to keep an eye on as we turn the calendar over and look ahead. Anything else that you're looking forward to in a new season, Rob?
Boy, I guess that's interesting, right? If that actually happens, right, we might be looking at an Ivy League of athletic scholarships. Wouldn't that be something? What am I looking forward to? You know, just another season, and a season that's maybe a little bit healthier than this one. So that's what I hope and I pray about all the time, is that we just are in a better place next year than we were this year. And, you know, the only cancellations we get are weather-related for next year.
That's right. Well, we had one or two of those, too, didn't we?
Yeah.
Let's hope we're in a healthier place as a society in every possible way in 2022-23. I think we can all get there together, and that seems to be a great note to end on. Certainly grateful for the IHO team. We did it together this season. Great staff. You know, wonderful writing from you. Great contributions from Erica Denhoff, George Clark, our toothless tiger friend, Princeton scribe, Nathan Solomon, covering Cornell, Richard Kent, covering Yale, Steve Silverman, providing color commentary for Princeton. A fantastic piece looking ahead to Penn's next season. You know, why the expectations are so high there, from Ian Wenick, former partner at the DP at Penn. You know, just great stuff all around. And yeah, thankful for the team and for the readers. And thank you, Rob, for pulling it all together, knowing all things Ivy Hoops. Certainly you made the scene a much more knowledgeable, enjoyable one this season, as you have in past, many past years now. So thank you, Rob.
I appreciate it. You're more than welcome, and it's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure, you know, to work with everybody in the group: Richard, Polister, Pete, Erica, George, Steve, and Ian. And you know, you're the glue that holds everyone together, Mike. I know, you know, I say it a lot, but it's certainly true. You're the sane voice that kind of keeps everybody, you know, in place and keeps things moving forward. and just really thankful for all the players and the coaches and the people at the league office. You know, we sometimes have comments or criticisms, but you know, all in all, I think, you know, I know I appreciate the effort they all put forward on a daily and weekly basis, and I know everybody else in the group, you know, thinks the world of them as well. And just really, really glad that we made it through this season, you know, in one piece, as a collective group. And I think we had a really, really great season, all things considered. And I think it's only going to get better from here. So, yeah, lots of positives in retrospect from me.
Yeah, can't forget Palestra Pete. Palestra Pete, it's a pleasure to edit his stuff. Doesn't require much editing at all. Best Penn women's hoops writing you're gonna find, certainly. But grateful most of all to the readers and listeners. Thanks for the patience. If you've stuck with us this long, you deserve a rich reward, and that reward will be wrapping it up right now. So thank you very much for listening, and appreciate it, and we'll see you again. Take care.